The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 562 for Sunday, July 19th, 2015.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. The show that's been called Car Talk for Apple Geeks. We answer your questions. We share your tips. We share our own tips. We share all kinds of stuff. And the goal is that we learn lots of new things each and every time we come together. Being Sunday morning, we're going to lower the goal a little bit to maybe three new things minimum. But feel free to set your own goals beyond that. That's our gift to you. Sponsors for this show include Barebones Software at barebones.com, makers of BB Edit. We will talk a little bit more about that shortly during the show. Linda at lynda.com/mgg, where you get 10 free days of the future of learning with Linda's awesome training videos on just about every topic. Talk more about that during the show. And also Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com, one of our favorite places for RAM and hard drive upgrades and really any kind of upgrade. So we will talk more about them during the show, too, here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in soon-to-be sweltering Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
Good morning, John F. Braun. How are you today?
It is a good morning.
I think so. I think so.
In my air-conditioned little hidey hole here?
Yeah. I'm still rehydrating from last night. I helped a friend of mine produced a Tommy tribute show that these guys from Sweden put together. They came all the way over here to do it. And so I actually sang a couple of songs with them, which was a true pleasure. And they used my drums and a bunch of the gear that we use in the band Fling that I play in. So we were out late, really just loading out gear, being glorified roadies. So I'm rehydrating is what I'm doing. It's all good. So I want to talk about BB Edit from Barebones. Barebones, of course, being our first sponsor for the show here today. BB Edit is one of those products that is synonymous with the Mac and really doing any kind of text editing or editing at all on the Mac. It's been around for decades. And Barebones lives up to their motto of making software that doesn't suck. Actually, they go way beyond that. It's not that it just doesn't suck. It's awesome, right? I mean, that motto doesn't do justice to the care and craftsmanship that goes into their software. And BB Edit is a fine reflection of that. BB Edit's a text editor at its core, but it's so powerful with what you can do. One of my favorite things to do with it is compare documents. For example, when the most recent terms and conditions were updated from Apple, from the iTunes store, I keep an old copy of the terms and conditions around, and I figured I wanted to know what the differences were, and maybe you would want to know what the differences were. So I actually used BB Edit. Without BB Edit, I could not have crafted this article. And it was actually an article that did quite well for us. So I took the old version. I opened it up in BB Edit. I took the new version and opened it up. And the nice part is BB Edit kind of dismisses all the formatting and bolding and italicizing and all of that. And you just get raw text copied, two versions of it, the old, the new. And then you say, find differences. And it brings up this awesome three-paned view with both documents in their own panes, and then at the bottom, a view that shows you what the differences are, line by line. And so you go through and you click on, line 42, what's the difference? And then it brings both documents to line 42, and even within the line, it highlights where the changes are. So in real time, you can kind of scroll back and forth, and it all sort of matches up, and it's this very fluid thing, really really handy to do, and one of my favorite ways to find differences. And so I did. I just logged through them, and some of them are stupid. Some of them's like, well, they changed the space, right? They had two spaces, and they made it one. Okay, well, we're not gonna detail that one, right? But sometimes when they make changes to wording and stuff, it's important for us to know. That's just one of the things BB Edit can do. I use it to count words in documents. And these are all just normal user things. We haven't even gotten into the coding things, which is what BB Edit's actually written for, right? I mean, it's written for programmers and all of that stuff, but I use it every day, and half of what I use it for is coding, and half is, like I said, you know, comparing documents, counting the number of letters, counting the number of words, counting the number of lines. If you need to do find and replace in many files simultaneously, you can point a folder, open up a folder with BB Edit, and say, go in that folder with all those documents, find this and make the change to that, and it'll open them and save them and iterate through everything. It's awesome. Really, really fantastic piece of software. You got to check it out. Barebones.com. They'll let you download a free trial because that's who they are. And then from there, you know, you'll decide you love it and you can go and buy it. It's $50 when you're ready, but go check out that free trial because I think you're going to love it. Barebones.com. John, last week we did Cool Stuff Found, as you know, and there are always things we don't get to fit into Cool Stuff Found, and especially we can't fit those things that we didn't know about until we saw them afterwards. But one of them, and we'll talk about another product from this vendor in a minute here, but one of them is called Disk Sensei. And it's from Sindori. These are the people that brought us Trim Enabler, which is what we're going to talk about in a moment here. But this is a killer utility and really, really smooth stuff. It's a dashboard, I guess, is the right way to look at it. Or it starts with a dashboard that shows you all this information about the disk or disks in your computer, what kind of drive it is, the firmware, the capacity, the temperature, drive health, all kinds of stuff. And it shows you how full your drive is and how much data you've written to it and read from it. And you get all this great stuff. So you really, really got to check it out. It's a good diagnostic tool, shows you all the health stuff on your drive. So that's one that's going in my toolbook. So toolbox. I don't know. Have you checked out Disk Sensei, John?
No, I just brought it up here, and I think bits and pieces of that info are available in other utilities that you and I use.
That's right.
Looks like this is a nice way to concentrate it all in one place.
It is. So, you know, while we're talking about Disk Sensei, it seems appropriate to talk about the subject that is the focus of another one of their utilities over there, and that is Trim Enabler. And I believe you can enable this functionality with Disk Sensei. Trim Enabler is a more focused piece of software. But we talked a lot about Trim two shows ago. Trim being a garbage collection process functionality of SSDs that requires tie-in from the operating system. And as we discussed in 10.10.4, Apple has unofficially and very much unsupportedly given us the ability to re-enable Trim at an OS level without having to you know, change kernel extensions or anything like that. And that's great. But one of the things we talked about was that there are some drives, specifically these Samsung drives, some Samsung drives, that don't properly support Trim. And there can be damage, right? You had brought that up, John.
They're overly enthusiastic in that they clear out more data than they should, which is what Trim does essentially. It basically cleans things up for you. But yeah, they had a bug in their implementation on some of their drives. So it would basically erase data. And that's terrible.
It is terrible. And I said, well, I'm throwing caution to the wind. You know, these drives have been used with Trim on Windows by default for, you know, forever. I've always used it on the Mac up until Yosemite. And so I did a little more research after the show and found that, in fact, there is this bug. And it is specifically about what's called queued Trim commands. And when you send queued Trim commands to these particular drives, they don't always respond in the right way. And John, you crystallized that perfectly. However, there's only one operating system right now that sends queued trim commands, and it's Linux. And all of these drives are now blacklisted in the latest drivers on Linux from being able to receive queued trim commands. So it's not a problem on the Mac. It's not a problem, on Windows. It's just a problem on Linux if you don't have things up to date. So I just wanted to share that because it's an important distinction. So,
yeah. And I thank you because during that show, I said, I'm scared and sure. I'm not going to do TrimForce. But after you reassured me and did some additional research, I then went to both my machines, which both have SSDs, and I did enable it. And so far, so good.
Good for you. Hey, awesome. That's killer.
Yeah, living on the edge.
Yeah.
Taking one for the team.
Hey, while we're kind of catching up from cool stuff, Haystack Software makes a backup package called ARC, A-R-Q. And the cool part about ARC is you buy the software once, and then you can back up to anything you want. They don't sell a backup service. They sell backup software. And then it's up to you to decide where you want this data to go. And so, and they support all kinds of features and backup destinations. You get to pick your cloud, and they support Google Drive and Dropbox. And if you have an FTP, an SFTP server, you can put it there. They support OneDrive and Amazon S3 and Amazon Glacier, right? And now they support Amazon Cloud Drive. And the reason that's a big deal is because of the pricing. Amazon Cloud Drive for $60 a year gives you unlimited storage. This isn't just unlimited storage for one computer. Creative people can figure out what that means, right? You could theoretically get one Amazon Cloud Drive account and use Arc, which you'd also buy, and you'd have to license Arc properly for multiple computers. And I honestly don't know how that works. We'll find out. But that's it. Oh no, for Arc, I know it now. So you can buy Arc for $40 flat fee for one computer forever, or you can sign up for a $10 a month Arc personal account, which now supports unlimited computers and actually comes with some storage. So it's coming. That's not out yet. So they're doing a little, they are actually enhancing the product. So $40 a computer gets you a copy of Arc and then your one Amazon Cloud Drive, $60 a year account, and you can dump all your data there. So that's a pretty compelling story for online cloud backup. And I wanted to make sure everybody knew. Don't you think, John?
So what do you mean by unlimited?
Yeah, exactly. See, that's why I think Flickr was really smart to roll out 1 terabyte of storage, right? I think it's actually unlimited. I don't think they'll stop you if you hit 1 terabyte. Has anybody out there hit 1 terabyte of pictures with Flickr uploads? I mean, it would take a lot. My wife's iPhoto library is 230 gigs. And or photos library, but migrated from iPhoto. So it still contains a lot of the cruft that iPhoto leaves behind. But her 230 gig photos library, when uploaded to Flickr, translates to about 80 gigs of photos. Still a lot of photos, but, you know, so you'd need, you know, 2+ terabytes of photos in a photos library to max out your Flickr account.
Yeah. I wonder how long they're going to do that. Because, you know, I've just taken a peek on one of my machines here, is that I'm almost certain at one point that I did have a small amount of Amazon Cloud Drive storage, because I think they threw it in just if you were a Amazon customer, which
that's
I am.
Right.
I just checked now and they said, we got new plans. You're going to have to make a decision here and give us some money. So,
right.
Yeah. Because I've seen other cloud services do the same thing. They said, oh yeah, unlimited. And then eventually reality hits and they're like, we're going to have to kind of back off on that a bit, but well, we'll see. It's Amazon.
That's the thing, is Amazon has a ton of storage. I don't know that even the, you know, the edge cases are going to cause them a problem. So we can talk about this now. Brian Monroe, when I mentioned my wife's photo strategy, he asked if she was using Google Photos as well. and Brian Monroe asked this in our chat room at macgeekab.com/stream. Greetings, everyone. She is, but here's the thing. We're not using iCloud Photo Library for her because Flickr, frankly, provides the cloud storage for free. And when you upload your iCloud Photo Library from your Mac, or when you upload your Photos Library from your Mac to Flickr, it inherits all of your albums and all of that stuff. So you really do have this you know, cloud repository that fairly well matches what you have locally. And it can even do more things. You know, you can go onto Flickr once it has your photos and say, find me pictures of vehicles, and it will find all vehicles. And you can say, okay, narrow that down to airplanes, and it will show you pictures of airplanes. I mean, it's doing some processing on these, which is cool. Google Photos, the problem with Google Photos is the upload path for the Mac, frankly, sucks compared to Flickr. Flickr, you run their Flickr uploader app. It sits in the background. As I mentioned, it intelligently parses and then transfers your photos library up to the cloud, preserving all this data. Whereas Google Photos, you have to manually drag pictures into the web browser interface or their uploader. I guess maybe they have a Mac uploader, but it's not intelligent. It doesn't parse through. It is intelligent from iOS. So if you have all your photos on iOS, then yes, it will back them up. But unless you're using iCloud Photo Library, you're not going to have all your pictures on iOS, chances are. And so therefore, it's not really the right thing. Flickr is still the right thing. But I promised I would follow up on my wife's Photos Library thing. So we took her iPhoto Library always lived on our Synology NAS. I copied it over to a 500 gig SSD, which I knew had enough room to, you know, to do the migration, because I wanted to do it local to the computer just in case. And so then I, you know, I plugged it into her computer. I pointed the iPhoto at that so that it saw it there. And we did the migration there, or the upgrade, or whatever you want to call it. And it did its magic and did its hard links and all that stuff. And we let it process through and create all its thumbnails and do all the things that it needed to do locally on our machine. And then when we were done, I copied the Photos Library back to the NAS, to the Synology NAS, and then pointed her Photos, you know, application at that. And it's been working flawlessly for, 2 weeks now? No problem whatsoever. I think part of the trick is getting the data to and from the NAS. You have to use the network. Like I thought, ooh, it'd be faster if I just plug this USB 3, you know, SSD directly into my Synology and just blasted the data there. But there's all of this metadata that potentially could come along with an AFP connection, the you know, the network connection that that OS X uses when it talks to Synology. And I thought, you know, we might want to preserve that. So I just let it do the copy over the network, which frankly isn't that long. I mean, I've got gigabit Ethernet here. And so, you know, that path worked very, very well. And so now she's got photos and she uses Photo Stream. So her 1,000 most recent photos are on all her devices. And with Flickr, anything that goes into Photo Stream that makes it to her Mac gets uploaded to Flickr. So it's a perfect little solution. It's the implementation of the solution we've talked about here on the show many times. So it real life and it works. And Alex is asking for a flowchart for it. Okay, Alex, just for you, I'll do it. Hey, you know what? Let's we had a good follow up and a question from our good friend Mr. X. So let's. Mr. X, why don't you take it away? Oh, no. Click there.
Hi, this is Mr. X again. About episode 546. I know I'm a little behind, but I'm catching up. There has been an acknowledged, at least among users, reliability problem with the first generation of time capsules, the ones that were capable of 2.4 or 5 gigahertz, but were not dual radio, where you had to choose between one or the other, that there was something with the power supply, and it tended not to manifest itself for at least a few years. I think I had one of those, and I got about 4 or 5 years out of it. The other thing I would suggest, if you're having a problem with routers dying, is get Ethernet surge suppression between your cable modem and your router. We used to lose routers at my house every 18 months or so, but I got a battery backup that had Ethernet protection, and I wired that in between the cable modem and the router, and the next router I got was an Asus, and that one lasted like 3 or 4 years, and now I've got an Apple Time Capsule, the second generation, that is 2.4 and 5 gigahertz simultaneously, and that thing's still going strong. That's all I had to say. That's it. Bye.
Thanks, Mr. X. Yeah, I went through exactly that. Thankfully, my power supply in that very first gen Time Capsule died within my 1 year warranty. Actually, no. It died within the 3 year warranty, but because I had, this is one of those things, and I haven't tested this recently. So if you have John or anybody out there, let us know. With AppleCare, if you have AppleCare on your Mac, it spills over to some other things. And at that point in time, it was spilling over to routers, the Time Capsule specifically, and also displays. So I was able to get it fixed under the umbrella of one of the iMacs that I had bought, you know, around the same time that I had AppleCare on. And they swapped out the power supply. So that's actually a tip. Remember that and dig into that when you have, you know, any Apple peripheral that sort of starts getting flaky. It might actually be covered under an extended warranty of your Mac. Yeah.
Yeah. I had one of those, and in my humble opinion, it's a piece of junk, and that's where it went. I brought it to the our recycling center, which will rip that stuff apart and dispose of it properly. Yeah, you remember we had the whole battle royale about 2.4 versus 5. And I'm like, well, no, I'm seeing this.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, what you're seeing means that it isn't doing it right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm much happier with I have now the fourth generation Extreme.
Right, right.
Which I'm still kind of, still does some weird things. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I have an idea for you. Let's talk after the show. I've got this Netgear router that I've been wanting to check out, but maybe you're the right one to check this one out. So
wireless.
Yeah. I might have something to send you. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Cause I've seen some around. I've been considering, I've seen some AC units, although I don't currently have AC. Any hardware that, although I don't currently have any devices that do AC, as far as I know.
Your iPad Air doesn't?
Oh, does it?
It might.
Yeah. Okay.
It might. Right,
that may. Yeah. But neither of my computers do because they're.
Oh, yeah. Your computer's just shy of that, right?
Yeah. Well, I got the 2012. The oldest machine is 2012, and I think that's still on N, which, hey.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. I actually still use that first gen Time Capsule. The wireless radio has not been on in years because it's worthless, as you pointed out. And I just use it as another time machine backup. I know the drive in there will die, but it's a 1 terabyte drive that sits on my network. And so fine. I let it sit on my network and I point a couple of computers to it.
Yeah. I think I actually liberated the drive out of that before. I think it was it a one?
It was a
terabyte?
One. That's right. It was a one.
Yeah, I think I liberated that drive and threw it in the Drobo.
Oh, smart.
The Drobo was like, thank you.
Yeah, I'll take it. That's right. Yeah. I do want to take a minute and John and quickly talk about our second sponsor, which is Lynda at lynda.com/MGG. The folks at Lynda, I really believe this is the future of education. And the nice part is not only can you test it out very inexpensively. In fact, you can test it out for free because that link gives you 10 free days. But even when you want to pay full price for it, it's really inexpensive, right? Because it's only $25 a month to get access to their entire course catalog. This is why this is the future of education. You get to do it on your own pace, right? You can do it at home. You can do it on the subway. You can do it on an airplane. You'd have to pay for a slightly more expensive account that lets you save the videos offline, which is fine. You literally can learn anywhere and you get to learn at whatever speed you want. Right. So and I, you know, my son has been taking a geometry course on his own. And it's really nice to be able to just go at your own pace. This is killer, right? Because you don't have to, if you're fast at this particular subject, you don't have to wait for and go at the speed of the average of the class, right? Or even worse, the speed of the slowest student in the class. You get to go at your speed, and that's okay. If you're the slowest student, that's okay, right? You go at your speed. But if you're the fastest student, you get to go at your speed too. And these courses cover everything, right? I mean, you can learn all the kind of traditional stuff, but you can also, they've got programming courses in there. They've got accounting courses. They've got, if you have ever fancied yourself, say, a photographer, and you want to take some courses about how to compose pictures, boom, there you go. And then if you've taken those pictures and now you want to learn how better to edit them, find a course for whatever your favorite software package for editing pictures is, and Linda has them, and then you can go take that course. And again, we're not talking about paying per course. Pay $25 a month, and you can take as many courses as you like. It's brilliant, and they're so well done. These teachers are absolutely fantastic, best in class. Some of them have actually been hired full-time by Linda, so they are staff teachers, but staff instructors, I guess, is a better way to say it. But some of them are people that are just out there like us doing what we do, and then also doing the Linda thing. So you've got to check this out. These courses are awesome. They have, you know, thousands of courses, but none of them are long in the tooth. They take stuff offline all the time that's not relevant. And sometimes we'll update it to make it relevant again. Or if it's a topic that's no longer, when the topic itself is no longer relevant, they just take it offline. So they're not padding their catalog with fluff. All this stuff is killer and current. You got to check it out. Linda, LYNDA.com/MGG gets you those 10 free days. And please do use that LYNDA.com/MGG thing. It lets them know we're the ones that told you to go there. And that's good. It's as good for them as it is for us, which makes it good for you. It lets them know that we're the ones that sent you there. They know that their advertising works, and you get to have them continue to support this show. So it works all the way around. But go ahead and sign up for your 10-day free trial. Check it out. It's the summer. It's a perfect time to just learn that one new thing. You don't have to go crazy. Just one new thing. It's fun. It's what we do here. Moving to Jay, John, and Apple Music. Oh, Apple Music. I'm still pretty pleased with it, to be honest with you. It works way better than iTunes Match worked prior, and I still have an iTunes Match account. But
for you, it does.
That's the thing. Well, I didn't say it was perfect. I said it works way better than, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's level set.
Well, level okay. Set. Right. Jay says, my inquiry relates to playlists in iTunes. Is there a way to have them show or populate in the new iCloud Music Library? It seems that the only playlists that can be in the iCloud Music Library have to be created on the iOS device and not imported from iTunes. Before, you could create a playlist in iTunes and sync that playlist to your iOS devices. My second inquiry, not all of my music in iTunes is showing in my iCloud Music Library. From the looks of it, that music is not showing. The music that is not showing comes from non-Apple sources like Amazon, Google, and other older CDs that I've just ripped into iTunes. Is this possibly due to a format issue or barrier, revenue license reconciliation, or Apple locking me into its ecosystem and not playing well with others? P.S. I have tried to change some of the music files to other formats, and it's still a no-go with them, and that they don't appear in my iCloud Music Library. Under the settings, show Apple Music and iCloud Music Library are checked and enabled. All Apple devices are running latest software with updates. So here's the thing, Jay. All of the stuff that's not happening for you should automatically be happening for you, and in a broad sense, happens for everyone. Now, there are a couple of things that will cause iCloud Music to not work. So let's talk about these two checkboxes that Jay mentioned, right? And if he's right, if you go in on your Mac, iTunes preferences, you will see two checkboxes under, I believe it's general, and I'm gonna do it here, even though that's a risky move while you're recording a podcast. In the general tab, yep, there are two checkboxes right at the top. Number one is show Apple Music. That will show you the radio stuff and the for you recommendations based on all of that. The second is iCloud Music Library, which described in the preference pane says store all of your music in iCloud and access songs and playlists across all of your devices. This is the part that is not working for you, Jay, right? It's clear you have access to Apple Music, but for whatever reason, iTunes is not actually enabling iCloud Music Library. And I've been through a little bit of this, but only because I screwed it up on my own. When I first turned it all on, it worked great. And then I was traveling and I was, I saw the reports that iCloud Music Library was replacing iTunes matched songs and artwork and all of that. And I got scared, frankly. So I remote accessed into my computer and I turned off that checkbox. And then, of course, I realized it was all fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and was not, in fact, true in a sense that it would have affected my main iTunes library. So I went to turn it back on. I turned it back on. It didn't come back on. I tried again. It didn't come back on. I have more than 25,000 songs in my library. This has not been a problem with iTunes Match, even though it yells at me and says I can't match new songs. It's fine. No problem. I got that. iCloud Music Library somehow turned on, even though I had more than 25,000 songs, probably because I had iTunes Match, and so it just sort of piggybacked on that. But once I turned off iCloud Music Library, which also then turns off iCloud Match on that computer, I could not re-enable it until I was stupid. I actually removed songs from my library, re-enabled it, got it all synced up, and then added those songs back in. It meant I lost playlist data from those, and I created more of a mess for myself than I should have. What I should have done was gone back to a backup of my iTunes file in Time Machine, but I digress. These are the things that should work for you with iCloud Music Library, and I've seen it on my wife's machine when she enabled iCloud Music Library. It scanned her library, and then I saw it uploading tracks that she had that were not in iTunes. And other people don't have access to those, but she does on all of her devices, and all of her playlists are synced and all of that. So as long as you're not at this 25,000 song limit, you should be seeing all this stuff. So my advice in this situation, again, with the caveat that you shouldn't mess with anything if you have more than 25,000 songs, or at least know that you might wind up in a world of hurt if you do, is to turn it off, hit OK, quit iTunes, come back into iTunes, turn it back on. That should force a resync. If it doesn't, turn it off and then also go into the account menu. I believe that's where you're going to see that, and disable Genius, because this data, it's sort of related to the Genius data. There's this database that Apple locally on your computer keeps and then uploads parts of that to the cloud. So turn off Genius, make it recreate your Genius database by then turning it back on, then re-enable iCloud Music Library. And hopefully that does it. It's one of those, you know, turn it off and turn it on things. But if you call Apple support, they are getting up to speed and they're doing a fine job, but they are, based on my personal experience with them and then also all the reports we're getting from you folks, the Apple support people were not happy having iCloud Music Library just dumped in their laps with no training. And that's what they've said to many customers, is that that's exactly what happened. So they are eager to help, but not necessarily full of answers, if that makes sense. Thoughts, Mr. Braun? You still with me?
I'm with you.
All right.
Honestly, I haven't been doing much with the iTunes or with the music as of late. So I've not had reason to shake my fist.
Yeah. Have you done the thing where, I mean, you've got iCloud Music Library and Apple Music turned on, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, no. Okay. A couple of shows ago, you had, coerced me into, against my better judgment, or to sign up for the trial, for the listeners. Again, sure. I'm taking one for the team here.
Have you tried
it? The only hiccup I had was
have you tried it remotely, where you're streaming music from your library remote? Okay, that works for you.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Cool.
Yeah, the only thing is that I had not enabled it on my iOS devices, you know, so I was like, well, what a piece of junk. I'm not seeing my music on my iOS devices. And you were like, well, dude, you got to turn it on. And I'm like, yeah, for whatever reason, it doesn't turn it on by default, whereas at least on my Macs, it did.
Right.
It seemed to figure it out. Yeah, no, it's kind of nice. I don't know if, I don't know if I'm getting much out of it. So I may just do the free trial.
Sure. Well, and I mean that, yeah, there's two pieces of it is the functionality and all of that and does it work? And then also, does it provide you a value that you care about? You know, like yesterday for me, I totally relied on it because I got to the theater early in the day because they were using my drums, which actually we had dropped off earlier in the week, but I got there early because I had to bring some cymbals for them. And so as they're setting up, I was on deck to sing one song in this whole Tommy tribute. I sang Pinball Wizard, which was totally a blast. And then they asked me the second set of the show was just Who's greatest hits kind of thing. And the guitar players came up to me and they're like, "Hey man, Henrik was supposed to sing Substitute, but he doesn't know the words. He didn't know we were doing the song." And he's like, "So, do you want to sing it?" I'm like, "Well, I don't know the words." And they're like, "Yeah, it's fine. You can have a music stand or whatever." I'm like, "Okay, but couldn't he?" And they're like, "Well, it'd be better to just have a guest." I'm like, "Okay, great. Sure. Yeah, I'm in." You know, I got less sense than fear, so I'll happily do these things. But with iTunes Music, with Apple Music, I was able to just stream. I have a couple of copies of Substitute in my music library, but they weren't on my phone. And I was able to stream them, you know, from my library to my phone. And I always had problems doing that with iTunes Match. And it's been flawless for me with Apple Music. And I could have streamed a copy from Apple too, you know, just from the music streaming. I could have streamed it from them. But the point was, I was able to listen through to the song, get some of the, you know, the phrasing of some of the lines, because Roger Daltrey's a weird kind of singer. And so it went mostly well. I missed an entrance cue. And so then it became like a Who show, and everybody on stage is kind of looking around like, "Hey, what's going to happen next?" It's like, good. Feels dangerous. We did the right thing. But Apple Music helped us get there. So it is handy. It's great. And what's awesome about Apple Music, try this out. You know, if I'm driving in the car, of course, because it's Apple Music, Siri is totally tied into it. So I can just press my Siri button, you know, the home button on my phone, and I can say, "Play the album Tommy by The Who," and it just plays it. There's no more fanfare. I mean, there is fanfare, but it's the fanfare in the beginning of the Tommy Overture, right? It's awesome. So that's the big leg up that Apple's got, right? Is that this is all tied in with their whole, you know, their device ecosystem. You can't do that with Spotify right now. I'd have to like go into Spotify and fumbling with the app and breaking the law and all that stuff. Now I just say, "Play me this song," and it plays me this song. "Play me that album," it plays me that album. It's killer. I love it. It's good. It's fun. So yeah, I'm pretty bullish on it. Time to move on to Rob, I think. Rob says, "I have a huge problem with Apple Music. Even Apple Support's own people are experiencing the same issues as me, and the lady I spoke with was equally as frustrated as I am and admitted that since my initial call to her that she noticed that she too had the same problem herself. The problem is that it relates to the mismatching of tracks and album art when I enabled iCloud Music Library. I have approximately 6,000 tracks and 500 albums, and I'd say 20% have now all been assigned incorrect album art on my iPad, as well as replacing some songs from a live album with their studio versions. My media is stored locally on my Mac, which also has iCloud Music Library enabled, but all the tracks and album art have remained intact there. I've turned on and off iCloud Music Library and re-upload, rematched my music, resynced my iPad, created a new library on my Mac and enabled iCloud Music on that, then deleted all the tracks. So that process is how you clean out iCloud Music Library, right? You create a new library on your Mac and leave it empty. But when you sync, or you can do this on another Mac too, but if you only have one Mac, you just create a new library with holding down the Option key when iTunes starts. And you create a new library, add it to iCloud Music, and then suddenly you'll see everything that's in iCloud Music. Well, at that point, you can highlight everything, Command, Option, Delete, and it will say, hey, do you want to delete all this stuff from the cloud? And you say yes, and boom, it's gone. That's the way you wipe out the cloud to start over. And he's tried that, but it didn't work. And this was the problem that when we first heard these reports and it wasn't real clarified, made me turn off iCloud Music Library, was this whole mismatching of tracks thing. Just to be clear, and Rob even said this, it's mismatching the artwork and sometimes even the songs when he's trying to download or stream it to his remote devices. But the main source of his music, his one particular Mac from which all of it came, has remained intact. So it's that it's matching it poorly when it goes up to the cloud. And then, of course, once it's in the cloud incorrectly, you try and stream it down to another device and it pulls the wrong thing. This also means if you delete your local copy on your main Mac and then decide later you're going to replace it or, you know, re-download it from the store, it might also be mismatched. In fact, it almost certainly would be. This is a problem Apple is aware of and has to work on and fix. But it's not easy. You know, this whole matching of things, if they're too strict about it, it won't match anything. And if they're too loose about it, this happens. So it's a fine line that they have to walk. And my guess is, you know, this is going to be something that iterations of both the software we have on our devices, as well as the software Apple has on their servers, are required. And it, Rob said it didn't fix it, but this week's iTunes, whatever it was, 12.1.16 update, is supposed to fix some of this stuff. But these are the problems that Apple Music has these days. And that's just how it goes. I don't have a magic answer. I don't think, if anybody does, of course, let us know. Of course. Got something for us, John?
Do I?
Do you?
You mean Adam?
Go ahead. Sure.
Yeah, this is a good one, I think. And hats off to Adam here. So Adam writes, hi, guys. So I have an old G4. Yes, you heard that right. G4 Mac Mini running 10 point, I assume OS 10. Yes. OS 10, 10.5.8. Wow. Thought I was old school. All I use it for is to play a loop of music for my business's on hold system. I currently use iTunes 10.2.2. Two issues. One, when iTunes starts, it says the certificate for the server ax.itunes.apple.com is invalid. Number two, it pesters me to update to the latest version of iTunes constantly, even though I have software update turned off. How can I get that certificate okayed permanently and make iTunes not want to update? And I think I have an answer. I think I have two answers, Dave. So number one, I wish he would have sent a screenshot of exactly what certificate error he's getting. But I think what happened, based on the age of the system here, is I bet you, it could be two things. So one, that certificate may be in his keychain access. I can't tell because, believe it or not, I don't have a 10.5.8 system handy. but what you want to do is you can force trust behavior if you go to keychain access. So what you're going to have to do, so one is when you get this error, you should be able to expand it and then look at the certificate or certificates involved in this. So like I said, the certificate may be named ax.itunes.apple.com, or there could be a higher level certificate. And I suspect that's the case, Dave, and it's probably expired. And I think that's why this is happening. But what you can do is you can force the hand in keychain access. So what you want to do is once you find that certificate, is you go into keychain access and then you go, you're going to see subcategories on the left, and it's probably going to be system roots on the top and certificates on the category. And then you're going to see a whole boatload of certificates here. And again, I'm guessing it's probably going to be one that's called Apple Root. So Apple, like a lot of other people, have a root certificate that then signs other certificates. Now, what you can do is if you double click on that certificate, you're then going to see a couple of pull downs, and one is called trust. And I'm going to bet that it's probably set to, when using this certificate, use system defaults. Well, what you can do is you can, again, force the hand. And I think what's going to happen here is you probably want to highlight, well, you could either click on that pull down and say always trust. And I think that's going to get rid of that error message for you. Or you could get more specific and you could say, okay, trust over SSL, trust over SMIME. But I think in this case, if you just say when using the certificate, always trust, that should override the behavior and make it so you're not going to get this error message.
It does make your system less secure because, but that's just,
well,
I mean, potentially because you're saying, you're essentially punting and saying, I don't care about the validity of these security certificates. But the thing is, if you do care about it, then you can't get to anything because they've all expired and you can't get updates, at least not easily.
Yeah, and I don't, you know, they may have, I mean, occasionally they'll release updates. It's usually folded into the OS. But occasionally they will roll out updated certificates because they do expire. But I think the problem here is that that machine, as far as I know, Dave, that machine 10.5.8 is the end of the line. That's the most recent version of the OS you can run on that machine.
Right.
So you're not going to get updated certificates. So, yeah, you make a good point. But the thing is, if you want to get rid of this error message, this is really the only way to do it.
Mm, right. Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying is you just have to know what sacrifice you're making. What compromise, I guess, is a better term.
The sacrifice making is that if you access a site that claims to be signed by Apple, and it's not, you're not going to get a warning.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough.
I think there's a low risk of that, but there's a risk. Yeah.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So it's good to point that out.
Yeah.
Problem number two. Now, again, I'm not running this version. So I think there are two solutions to this. So number one, and I hadn't thought of this because I didn't think this option was still here, but I'm looking in the latest version of iTunes, Dave, and I don't know if this is available in the crusty old version that he's using.
Okay.
But if you go to the advanced, so he said he turned off software update, and that's a good place to start, but that's not necessarily where iTunes, that's not the only place that you can tell the system to look for updates, because I'm looking right here, Dave. And so if I go to iTunes, preferences, advanced, there's a little checkbox. Check for new software updates automatically.
Yep.
If that's there, that would be the best way to do it, though that may not be there. I'm not sure with this older version if that option is available. If it's not, then I think the only way, or another way, if it even runs, again, we're talking old. what's happening, the reason that you're getting this message is because a lot of software will do what I call phone home, like ET. And that it goes to the mothership, or it goes to the maker of the software and says, yeah, hi, this is my version. Is there a newer one? You could use Little Snitch to block an attempt to do that. So if that checkbox is not there, that's the only other way I think you could do that, Dave, is intercept that request and deny it. And then if it can't get to the server to ask it what the latest version is, then you're never going to get that annoying update message.
Yeah. Well, you might get another message, maybe, saying can't contact. I don't know, right? Can't contact the server or whatever, but who knows?
It may yell at you I found most things when you disable it, it just assumes that the network is, you may get another message saying, I think there's something wrong with the network.
Right. So, right. Right. Yeah. Okay. Right. Right.
That's what I got.
All right. Sweet. I want to talk about OWC, our third sponsor for this show at MacSales.com. As I mentioned in the intro, these folks make upgrading your Mac and enhancing your Mac their priority. And really their priority is making this a smooth experience for you, both from the installation and application of the upgrade, as well as the price. They make it as easy on you as possible. I say this as a longtime customer of theirs. They clearly care about their customers here at OWC. They would not have lasted this long in our community if they didn't. But you know, they really focus on this, and they were the I think still the only people that have this Aura SSD. So if you've got a Mac Pro and you want to upgrade the SSD in your 2013, of tubular, what do we call it? Cylindrical Mac Pro. You can do up to 2 terabytes to the SSD in there. They've got a 1 terabyte option for $899 and a 2 terabyte option for $1,479, which is for the way these upgrades work, killer pricing, right? And they've got all the tools are included to do this, right? And that's the thing, is they make this easy for you. You open the box, they've got a video to show you how it's done, and then all the tools that you need to get in and out of your machine safely and responsibly are included right there with the actual upgrade. Comes with a 3-year warranty, and then you can take the factory SSD and put it into the case, because it includes their own Envoy Pro SSD enclosure. So they've already thought about it, right? You go in, you come out, you've put the new SSD that was in the box now in your computer, and of course you replace the one that was in there. You don't just want to throw it away. Hey, look in the box, look what's here, an external hard drive case. Put the SSD in that, and now you've got it as an external as well. Like, this is a type of attention to detail that the folks at OWC do, so that they create an experience, a full experience. You're not just buying, hey, I want that part, and now, ooh, I got to figure out what to do with it. You can do that, but really they create this package for you that makes it easy for you to get to the end, the full end of whatever that particular upgrade is. They're this way with RAM as well. John, you got an SSD from them at an amazing
and RAM.
Right. I know we've both gotten RAM, but
soon as I got this refurb, which had a puny little hard drive and inadequate RAM, they're the first people I went to upgrade those babies to something reasonable.
Respectable. That's right. Reasonable. That's right.
Yeah.
Something a human can do.
One-stop shopping. I got both my RAM and my SSD from them, and I'm very pleased.
And their customer support's awesome. Invariably, there are times when you get something that's just not going to function the way it's supposed to. And of course, they'll swap it out for you. That's obvious. Then what they do is they actually take the bad part into their lab here in the U.S., and put it through a whole QA process to figure out, okay, is this just a one-time problem? What's the problem? And then ask the question, is this a one-time problem? Or have we seen this before? And if so, maybe we shouldn't work with that supplier anymore. Or, they've sort of narrowed down their suppliers now. So, but it might be like, okay, wait a minute. You know, what kind of computer? They look kind of holistically at whatever the issue was. And it's like, okay, what kind of computer was this attempted to be used in? Is there something, you know, oddly incompatible? They've just got really smart people in every aspect of the process, so that the next customer doesn't, you know, go in with this same kind of problem. If in fact it's a problem that's systemic, even if it's systemic for just a small slice of their customer base, they really, really have this holistic view of what they do. And it makes a difference, because it makes the customer experience for all of us that much better. So you got to check them out. MacSales.com. They are, like I said, for RAM, hard drives, SSD upgrades. These are some of the ones you want to look at here. So check it out and let them know we sent you. They certainly appreciate it. I think they've got a little drop down when you're checking out. You can say that you heard about it from Mac Geek Gab, and they would appreciate that, as would we. John, a couple of shows ago, we raved about the 10.10.4 update, because finally my Mac, all of my Macs in my house feel like they should have on day one with Yosemite. I have this version of Yosemite that works. I was really, really excited about it. And we talked about this, and I said how I'd upgraded all my Macs and things were working great. And that's still true. And Mike wrote in and said all that in episode 560, you discussed the release of 10.10.4. This is Apple's fifth version of the OS, 5 tries and many months to get it right. And you are praising them for fixing issues that should not have been broken in the first place. Where are the John and Dave of old giving Apple a good old-fashioned fist shake when deserved? In fact, Apple deserved a fist shake and a rant. We need voices like yours to remind us that this is not acceptable. Keep up the good work, but be critical when it's deserved. And you're totally right, Mike. And I think, throughout the months, that since Yosemite was released, we had, you know, our little minor fish shakes and frustrations, but I was simply so happy to finally have these fixed that I totally lost sight of the fact that, you know, we should also, as you astutely did, have pointed out that this is also not acceptable. As good as it is that we finally get these fixes, it's not acceptable that we had to do this. We shouldn't, happy as we are, we should not have had this opportunity to be happy. And I totally agree with you. And it's one of the things I like with what they're doing with El Capitan, where they're adding some features and stuff like that. And of course, we're going to have a rough road, my guess is, you know, when it's released. Although with this public beta being truly public now, maybe if they listen to the bug reports, because they didn't listen to the bug reports for Discovery D, right? That was the problem. These bugs were reported a year ago during the private developer beta, and it took, you know, almost a year for it to get fixed. So hopefully Apple has learned that lesson, but it sure seems like they're really focused on you know, stability and speed and efficiency of the OS, which is what an OS should be focused on, I think, at least sometimes. So yes, thank you, Mike, for the reminder that we must, even when we're happy, we must keep a critical eye. We got time for a couple more, John. You want to do Scott? Get that rolling.
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Let me get. Oh gosh, where are you, Scott? You caught me by surprise. But now I have Scott.
Great.
Here we go. Because I learned something here. So Scott's question is regarding using an SD card volume for. Oop. Hold on. Ah, no, there's his, there's his question. Okay. Hi guys, two things. Well, we'll skip the first thing. Yeah. That was a question to you. Secondly, I have a new MacBook Pro bought this year, latest OS, and it has an SD card slot in the side. The SSD drive in my machine is 256 gigs. Assuming I had a 256 gig SD card in the slot, could I use that for Time Machine backup? ? I know the general consensus is 2 times my hard drive size for Time Machine, but since I only have about 80 gigs of data on the drive, it'd certainly be enough for now, and it'd be much nicer, and I could leave the SD card in there all the time instead of having to remember to plug USB drives in from time to time. Thoughts? And I'm going to give you some thoughts, Dave. Maybe even a fish shake. All right, you want a fish shake? It's coming. Now, first, I was pretty sure you could do this, Dave. But I wasn't entirely sure. So I went online and I looked at Apple's, Apple has an article about Time Machine. I'm like, well, let me check Time Machine. What do they have to say about it? And according to Apple says, well, hey, if you want to use Time Machine, you can back your files up to an external hard drive connected to a USB FireWire or Thunderbolt port. I'm like, well, that's, they didn't say SD, did they? Mm. Or USB port of a airport or an airport time capsule. So they don't say that you can, but they don't say that you can't. So I decided to find out, Dave. And I was looking around, and actually I didn't have any large SD cards handy. So I actually ordered a couple because, hey, everybody needs more SD cards, right? Or at least I did. So I went online and I got what looked to be some pretty decent SD cards. I'll have to find a link to them, but they were Lexar 32 gig high speed, or so they say. I think they were rated at 96 megabytes a second.
Okay.
It's pretty good.
Yep.
And of course they have a caveat saying, well, that's the read speed. The write speed's probably going to be a little slower, which is true of any memory.
Sure.
That I know of. So I'm like, okay. So ordered up some of those, put one in there, formatted it, which you must do for Time Machine. I formatted it as
HFS Plus.
Yeah, or Mac OS 10 Extended Journaled, is what Time Machine needs.
Right.
And so I formatted it like that. Then I went to Time Machine. And lo and behold, that drive showed up as a potential candidate for Time Machine backup.
Okay.
I'm like, okay, great. So, The answer is yes, you could do this. Now, in my case, since I already back up to my Synology, it said, well, hey, you want to back up to this instead, or you want to alternate between the two, which is something that they introduced a while ago in Time Machine, which I think is kind of slick. So I said yes and started the backup. I didn't complete it, but it was going through the motions. So I would say, yes, you can do this. So even though Apple doesn't explicitly say SD card. But then, Dave, then I has a sad because I'm like, well, you know, I wonder what kind of throughput we're getting here, because that was my warning. Is that, well, you know, SD cards, you got to, because some SD cards can be very slow.
Sure.
You want to make sure that you get one that's rated, and also the interface. So the first thing I did, Dave, is I researched the throughput of the that interface. And if you go to system info, you know, about this Mac, system info card slot, it'll say, oh, well, the data rate on this is 2.5 GTs per sec. Well, what the heck is that? Basically, when you do the math, so there's some encoding, 10-bit to 8-bit and all that stuff here. So it's gigatransactions per second. But basically, what that comes out to is about 300 megabytes a second. Okay, so that shouldn't be a bottleneck.
Right.
The SD card shouldn't be a bottleneck.
SD interface shouldn't be, because the card isn't going to run that fast, right?
Well, actually, I think there are cards that you're going to pay, but there are cards that approach that speed, believe it or not.
Okay.
I found some, but yeah, you're going to pay. I mean, these cards that I bought were like $20.
Yeah, well, I found the Lexar, just because the listener asked about 256 gig cards. So I looked, and the Lexar 90 megasecond 256 gig card is $160. But you can get a PNY 90 megasecond 256 gig card for $95. So I'll put both of those in the show notes. But that's not bad, right? $95 for 256 gigs.
Yeah.
Or is it?
Now here's where it started breaking down, Dave. So I'm like, you know what? I'm curious what the throughput is on this. So let me get a benchmarking utility. And I used what a lot of us like to use. But if you haven't used this, the Blackmagic Disk Speed Test is a swell tool for checking throughput on your drive. So I'm like, well, let me check the throughput on this drive. You can, of course, select a drive other than your primary hard drive. And so I selected it. And while I was getting, you know, nice read speeds approaching what they said, you know, 90 or so, I think I was seeing 80, 90.
Yep.
I was seeing horrible write speeds, like 10 megabytes a second. And I'm like, wait, something's wrong here. So at first I thought that Lexar was ripping me off, that they made, you know, because they do have, again, a little asterisk saying, well, read speeds are going to be slower.
Sure.
Or write speeds are going to be slower. And I'm like, well, dude, I mean, come on. I mean, 10.
That's way slower. Yeah.
Then I looked at the write-ups on Amazon, and people wrote in and said, well, here's the throughputs I'm seeing. I'm seeing like 45 write. And I'm like, well, wait a second. Why am I seeing 10 when other people are seeing 45? And I'm like, if only I had another device that I could test this with. And I do. So I got to thank my friends at, again, I do believe it's Lexar. Was it Lexar or SanDisk? I'll have to double check here. I'll link to it. But basically I have... that was given to me, and again, I'll link to the appropriate device here. But I have a USB 3 SD card reader, and even though it's called a reader, it's a reader and a writer. And I'm like, well, let me see the throughput if I put it in that device. And Dave, I put it in this device, and I got the speeds that I was expecting, the read and write speeds. So the message here is that for whatever reason, Apple's SD card implementation is, how do I put this? Less than optimal. And that if my experience is any indication, and I tried it on two machines, I tried it both on my MacBook Pro and I tried it on my Mac Mini, which also has an SDXC slot. That's what they call this.
Yeah.
And their write speed is just horrible. I don't know why it is. I can't, the only thing I can identify is it's the driver, because none of what I see in the hardware specs indicate that it should be. They even say, okay, it may be attached to a USB 2 bus, but even USB 2, Dave, is, you know, you should be getting 40 megabytes a second, right?
That's right.
You know, USB 2 is, so it's either attached to a SATA, I think an eSATA or a USB bus, but even then, so I'm baffled as to why I'm seeing such slow write speeds. So the answer is, do you want to do this? Yes and no. The thing is, if you do, you're going to have to put up with substandard write speeds, and you may find that frustrating.
And
maybe not for the amount of data that you're backing up. Maybe not. The initial backup may be very painful and it'll take forever.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's the question of how much of a beating is that flash memory going to take before it dies? Is that not a concern with an SD card? I mean,
I was looking that up, and I think any flash memory has a limited number of read cycles. From what I've read, even SD cards, you're talking kind of like SSD. So okay. You may have less. I mean, you're talking, from what I could find out, hundreds of thousands of write cycles before it stops doing what it does.
Okay.
But I think in the grand scheme of things,
this isn't a typical use case for an SD card, right? An SD card traditionally is, I'm going to throw a photo at it. I'm going to throw another photo at it. I'm going to throw another photo at it. And then I'm going to read all those off. Right. And that could be why Apple's driver has not been optimized, assuming, and I agree with you, that's the only thing that makes sense, is that it's just the driver. It's been optimized for reads because that's what you're doing with it, right? You're taking the card out of your camera, you put it in your Mac, and you slurp all the stuff off. So,
you do it? Yes. Do you want to? Hey,
I like it.
Up to you.
Yeah. Hey, you mentioned Blackmagic, and that, that reminded me of a post that Allison Sheridan put together where she was testing some of, actually from OWC's new Envoy SSDs, or the Envoy Pro Mini, the small one. And she tested it with Blackmagic because that's the one we all use. And it did not test up to the specs that she expected. So she talked to OWC, and actually she called me first. And she's like, do you have one of those? And I said, no. And so she called OWC, and they said, yeah, Blackmagic's not the right thing to test. You should use the AJA disk test. And it was because they're saying that, well, the title of her article says it all. All flash memory is not the same. And the article is about synchronous versus asynchronous SSDs. And it's the different types of flash memory that's being used for different purposes. And it's a great article. I highly recommend reading it. I'm not going to rehash it all here, but we'll definitely put a link in the show notes. This is important to understand that, the purpose for which flash memory is applied, or intended, I should say, will inform the decisions about which types of flash memory to use. And that can impact the way, say, writes are. And, Blackmagic doesn't write compressed data or compressible data, whereas, Asia does. And so you'll see higher speeds, but it may be more reflective of real world performance. If you're using a drive that's built for, say, dumping video to, that's basically uncompressible data at that point. So Blackmagic is the right test for that. And that's why those charts in Blackmagic talk about what types of video you can stream, just live to this drive. Whereas a smaller SSD, like a 256, you're not going to be, just dumping raw video to. And so it makes sense to use a different type of flash memory, but then you have to test it for its intended use case, or at least be aware that there is an intended use case. So it was an interesting article. Thank you, Allison, for writing it, because it's good to have this resource out there.
And it was a Lexar USB 3 reader, and it looks like they're not terribly expensive. Only about I found some out there for about $30. So,
oh, nice.
You may want to consider getting, if you want to get decent write speeds, you may want to consider one of those. Though he said, he'd rather not have something like that hanging off the side. So
yeah. Yeah, right. Then at that point, you might as well just buy an external drive and go from there. Because you don't need to store your backups on a SSD, right? That's where spindle drives are great. You just dump your backups to a spindle drive and be done with it. So, hey, while we're talking, Eric's question is one that has been asked of us quite a bit lately, and I wanted to address it here in the show. It seems to come around once every 6 months, or we let it percolate up into the show once every 6 months. We're probably asked this once a week. And Eric succinctly writes, I'm wondering if you can help thin out the list of options of Synologies. I want to get a disk station. I want to run a Plex server on it. I have Bose SoundTouch. I have an Apple TV. And I want to do some basic NAS functionality, just storing files. I have a ton of music, movies, TV shows, and photos. And you're right. If you go to Synology's website, it's a mess trying to figure out what what NAS works for you. And so we are happy to help. So the thing you want to really focus on is the CPU. Well, there's two things, right? The CPU that's inside the unit is something you want to be aware of when you're choosing what you're going to do. So that, cause that's going to limit or offer the capabilities of the unit. And then of course the number of bays that the drive, the number of drives that you can put in the thing. So they have 2-bay units all the way up to, I think, 16-bay units. For most of you listening here, the most you're probably going to want is an 8-bay unit, but even that might be overkill. Although I'm now running the DS1815 Plus here and it's awesome. I don't have all the bays filled in a sense yet. I have some drives for them, but I've been sort of mucking about with things. And so I haven't filled them all yet, but the important thing to focus on first is the CPU of the device, because that really is going to limit or be the factor that limits what you can do with it. If all you want is standard NAS functionality, any of these are going to be fine. And where I recommend you starting is looking at the DS214 Play, if you want a 2-bay unit, or the DS215 Plus. Both of them have dual core CPUs, but the DS214 Play actually has an Intel Atom CPU, which I think is a better choice right now for most people. Also because the DS214 Play has a hardware transcoding engine. So things like Video Station are going to be able to deal with your video files better because it's got the ability and hardware to do that. The DS215 Plus can do some of it with its built-in CPU, but you might run into some issues. Plex support for these units in the 200 series is doable, but you often have to jump through some hoops to make that happen. But Video Station, we have Plex installed on our Synology here, and we never use it. We use Video Station and stream directly to the Apple TV with that. So you might not need Plex, even if you think you need Plex. I have it running here, and I'm happy to share movie libraries and music libraries with anybody, but it's not, we don't use it for anything. However, there are other things you might want to do with your Synology. They've got Docker, which is this killer virtualization engine. You may want to do some movie conversions on it. And you might want to run CrashPlan. And if you, these things, in addition to needing CPU, also need RAM. And the 2-bay units each have a gig of RAM, and I believe it's soldered, so it is not even unofficially upgradable. But the good news is these are pretty inexpensive units. You can get them for a couple hundred bucks. They come with two drives, or you can get them. You can, if you get the Beyond Cloud system, which is a great way to get started because it's essentially a 214 Play, I believe. No, it's a 214 ES. And it'll do all of this stuff, and it comes with the drives, and it's easy to set up. But the good news with Synology is you can take the drives out of any smaller Synology and move them into a larger Synology, so more drive bays, and maintain all your settings, all your data, everything. It's a smooth upgrade. I've done it many times here, and it works really well. So with that in mind, then we start talking about the 15 series, which I call, because that's this year's model. And really there's two to look at. And frankly, really there's just one to look at, and it's the DS1515 Plus. The other one to look at is the 1815, the one I have here. But in terms of CPU capability, really the only difference between them is the number of bays. There's three more bays in the 1815 plus. The 415 is another one to look at. It is officially RAM limited in that it only comes with, let me find it here, 2 gigs of onboard RAM that is not upgradable officially, whereas the 1515 does have upgradable RAM. But there is a video that will show you how to upgrade the RAM and replace it and get yourself all the way up to 8 gigs in that 415. It will void your warranty almost certainly. And I've put together a little chart here that I'll put in the show notes so you can see all of these models compared in a really, really easy way. But looking for a quad core CPU in your NAS makes a big difference so that you can, like I said, and plenty of RAM. You want to have at least 4 gigs in that thing, preferably 6, to really do things. You know, running Crash Plan requires Java in there, and so suddenly your RAM requirements go way up. The same is true if you're going to run Docker, which is a virtualization engine where you can actually run apps and connect to a remote desktop on your Synology. And that, you know, of course, requires RAM because you're running a whole other operating system and whole other apps inside there. And then, of course, things like video and all of that, having the RAM to run all of these apps on your Synology makes for a smoother experience. So check out this chart that I put in the show notes. But man, that quad core CPU that's in the 415 plus, the 1515 plus, and the 1815 plus, it's awesome. Really, really, they've done a really nice job with this, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It's great. Honestly, if there was an officially supported path to upgrade the RAM in the 415 plus, I would recommend that all day long. But because there's not, I have to edge toward the 1515 plus. But if you're willing to get your hands dirty and potentially void your warranty, you know, the 415 plus has one RAM slot, but it is a slot. You can take the case off and just swap out the chip. And those chips are cheap. I think I got RAM for like, I don't know, $30 or something. It's a trivial cost. So it's good stuff.
Wow. Can I upgrade my RAM?
I don't know how much RAM do you have in yours? You have the 713 plus.
Yeah, and we had a separate conversation about that where someone asked, hey, should I get a Synology? And I'm like, hey, I kind of like my 713 plus. And you were like, well, yeah, but it's the, which is correct. Yeah, you looked at the product line more than me. But this is a relatively, this is a couple of years old. So it's not the latest and greatest. It still meets my needs. The answer is, I don't know. I'm looking right now. I'm logged into mine.
You have 1 gig of RAM in it. And I think it's not upgradable RAM wise.
Well, everything's upgradable.
But I don't know if yours is soldered.
I don't need. Yeah. It could be. Yeah. I'm looking right now and it says I'm using 25% of my RAM and
that's good.
Almost nothing of my CPU. So yeah, no, I don't need to.
Right. 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 Yeah. They're all good units. They have too many options. And I've told them this. I'm like, dude, you gotta focus down. And that's where they came with the whole Beyond Cloud thing, which is great because it lets you, it's a really easy way to get started. So, if you just want to get your feet wet with Synology, do the Beyond Cloud thing. I mean, you can get in there and get, 2-3 terabyte drives plus the unit, all packaged in one for like $240. So it's, I think, right. Am I getting that wrong?
Yeah.
Did I get that wrong? The one drive bay that you can do. So it's a single 3 terabyte drive. So it doesn't have any fault tolerance for $240, but it gets you started and you have the drive that you can then, bounce to a future one. 2-3 terabyte drives is about $90 more, $350, and you get the two drives inside the Beyond Cloud enclosure. It's great. And it really is a simple, easy way to get started. And then, if you want more capabilities, you take those drives out and put them in the next Synology you buy and you're off to the races. And it's really easy. So,
yeah, I think they have the problem that Apple had a while ago.
Yes.
In the bad old days, in that they had too many options. I mean, I'm looking right now, and the thing is, so they group them: large business, small business, medium business, home, work group.
No.
But even within that, you look and you're like, well, what's the difference? And right. Yeah, you could dig through the specs, but they got to, like you're saying, they're refining, or they're trying to create use cases. So, you know, kind of like they're starting to do here. It's just they offer too many options in each category.
Yeah, right.
My humble opinion.
No, you're totally right. You're totally right. Yeah, it's too many options. Yeah. And I'm sure each one of them is, you know, makes good sense when you argue, well, this drive will serve these needs and okay, fine. And you know, maybe they have some enterprise customers that are very specific about their needs. And they're like, look, we want, you know, 500 of something that matches this. And so they're like, yeah, shoot, we'll build it. And then why don't we put it in our product line and sell it to other people? Well, because then it's confusing and nobody knows what to buy. But that's why I put that chart up. So you can find the chart. And it's good. It really is. They do a nice job. I've been very happy, as you all know. So there you go. I think we have time for one more here, John. And I want to go to where are my notes here? I want to go to Scott, because Scott has more than just an interesting resolution, an interesting path there. It's a great story that I want to share. So Scott says, I contacted you guys back in March or April to tell you about my story of woes with a networking problem. As a very quick recap, I was losing wired connectivity to all machines on the network. I thought at first it was my airport router. However, I then thought maybe it was a bad Ethernet socket. I even swapped out the switch, the router, the cables, and even contacted anyone who would listen. I even asked the squirrels for their advice, but they just wanted to help. They wanted to help chew up wires and beg for peanuts. In the end, after many hours of troubleshooting, cursing, and cajoling, the issue turned out to be a bad USB to Ethernet adapter. I borrowed another one, an Apple adapter, from my employer, and I've been running it for about 6 hours with no problems at all here. The previous adapter would cause a total loss of wired access within 10 minutes or so of being connected. I just wanted to share the update because after all the mucking about, I'm sure another device I had considered, but perhaps not carefully enough. The reason why I missed this? Well, at the office, I've not had any issues when using the adapter. What finally clued me in is the fact that occasionally when starting the MacBook Air, the Ethernet was just not there. It was as though the adapter had never been connected. Unplugging it and plugging it back in would resolve the issue. The issue only occurred randomly, so I did not immediately connect the events. However, I'd been thinking about the issue for the last couple of months. I wondered if carrying the adapter back and forth to the office eventually caused a break in the pigtail between the adapter and the USB connector. Seems hard to imagine, but anything is possible. So thanks for sharing this, Scott. Yeah, you know, it's because it's a great story about a couple of things. You know, the first is you've got to do all the work and troubleshoot through, and then you kind of need to let it, if you haven't solved the problem, you kind of need to let it germinate sometimes in your head. And, you know, I call it driving time or shower time, that time when you're sort of in that, you know, trance-like state where you're doing something that's pretty much automatic to you. And so your mind gets to wander a little bit, right? And this is when, you know, the hard problems get solved, because your mind gets to sort of relax from its normal focus. And the stuff that's just swimming around gets to just swim around. And a lot of times the way I find it manifest is you get this gut feeling like, wait a minute, is it that? Trust your gut. You know, that's some of the best advice I can give, is trust your gut, because Scott let this swim around and suddenly was like, hey, wait a minute, there's this thing. And he noticed one thing and clearly it was on his mind, but you know, you got to have this stuff all in your head so that one little symptom that's not really related, but is, can be the trigger. So nice. Kudos to you, Scott. Thank you for sharing your story with us. It's good stuff. I think so. What do you think, John?
I think I want people to write us, Dave.
Where shall they write us?
Well, you know, my favorite, Dave, is sending an email to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
You said feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
No. I said feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
Yeah, that is what you said. It's true. 206-666-GEEK, folks, is the phone number you can call. And John, of course, Geek is?
4335.
That's what you say. They can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Facebook. Go to this URL. Start at MacGeekGab.com. Go to MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. That's going to get you straight to our awesome Facebook community. You got to check this out. Really, really good stuff happening over there. So if you're not philosophically opposed to Facebook, this is where you want to be. MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. That way we don't have to give you the crazy long, you know, hashed URL. We can just, boom, there you go. So come and visit us. As always, I want to thank Michael Johnston for all of his hard work helping us with this show. And he is the host of the iOS Show podcast, as well as the publisher of GetAppler.com, two fine properties out there. You got to check out the iOS Show. You're going to love that one. Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com is the place where we get all our bandwidth from to get the show to you. And they put it on all their servers all over the world, in fact. So it works really well. And that way, when you go to download the show, Cashfly's got a copy of the show near you, so you don't have to get it from halfway around the world. They take care of that all in one fell swoop. So thanks to them. The podcast marketplace, as we mentioned, of course, Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com. You got to check them out. Lynda at lynda.com/MGG for the future of education. Check it out. You can learn something right now. Even though you just learned stuff in this show, there's more stuff to learn from Lynda. Barebones at barebones.com, the makers of BB Edit, a text editor really, truly for everyone, not just for programmers, although if you're a programmer, you're going to love it too. Gazelle, GAZELLE.com is where you can sell off all your old stuff and get some cash. iMazing.com. Can't live without iMazing. They're doing some great stuff with iOS 8.4, too. We'll put a link to their blog post. Smile Software is where it's the home of Smile.com. And then, of course, Squarespace. Squarespace.com/MGG, where you can build your website and build it beautiful. I have some advice to share with you. I know I already shared trust your gut, which is important, but equally as, in fact, maybe a hair more important, because in order to be able to trust your gut, you have to follow this advice. Don't get caught.
Made up.